got all my ducks in a row here. Don't add to that picture as it's going on.
Sure.
I was quite tic-tac-toe.
All right, so here's what we're doing this year. We're reading through the Bible. Everybody's doing their daily Bible readings on their own. There's some print schedules here, but they're all at the site if you don't have one. And then we're reviewing what we're reading. So we're reading through 20 plus chapters a week, and we're trying to keep up and review. So we're going quickly, and I apologize for that in part, because to do a good job, we have to go through 10 or 12 chapters at a time. And then during our Sunday morning worship period, we're paying special... Okay, George, give me that.
More and more looking better.
Thanks. If I come with my hair blue next week, it's your fault.
No, the picture. Yeah, it's more like blue. Let's start looking a lot more like blue.
Can you do something about him? No.
He brought it on. I'm just commenting what he said.
I'm going to say this, I'm going to be done. Some people don't have any room to speak about the color of hair.
At least it's one
of them. All right, let's get started. All right. So we're reviewing the book of Deuteronomy. We started last week. We'll see how far we get. And I think we get out of the book of Deuteronomy in the next couple days. I think we're supposed to be through chapter 27 tonight. And there are 34 chapters. So in the next day or two, we'll be finished. So next week, we will wrap up what we don't finish in Deuteronomy and get into the next book, which, of course, is the book of Joshua. So everything that we see presented before in the book of Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers, some of that's going to be repeated. Not all of it, but some of it's going to be repeated. And so it's the second giving of the law. It's not the second law. It's the same law, but it's given a second time to a new generation. 40 years later, different time, different place. 40 years later, time, different place. They're about ready to go into the land of Canaan. Before, it was given at Mount Sinai. Just to repeat very quickly, they're only 11 days' journey from Sinai where they are. I said, it didn't take 40 years to get here. They wandered for 40 years because of the mistake that they made in Numbers chapter 13. They didn't do what God wanted them to do at the time that God wanted them to do it. So they're only 11 days journey with that huge group of people to get to this point. So there are lots of things that are mentioned again. So we alluded to this. God says in the context of the book of Deuteronomy that there's going to come a time where he's going to put his name at a specific place. So you know what it says in Joshua 24, verse 15, where Joshua says, choose this day whom you're going to serve, but it's for me and my house we serve the Lord. Well, the word choose there is the Hebrew term bakar, and it means to choose exclusively and without reference to anything else. It's to choose here, to choose this. The English word decision means to cut off everything else except that which you choose. And so if you choose this, it means you exclude everything else. And so that term is used in the Old Testament with reference to God's place of worship. God chose this place where he wanted to be worshipped, which means everything else he was excluded. So sometimes biblical authority is just like that. God designates this, and by virtue of the fact that he doesn't designate everything else, it's outlawed. It's left out. It's excluded. And so that's going to be a big deal when they come into the land. Because over a period of time, the children of Israel are going to pop up places of worship all over the place. There have been model temples and other places outside of the city of Jerusalem where people decided to do something other than what God wanted in the southern part of Jerusalem. And even during the period of the restoration, before the children of Israel came back, a bunch of Jews who had gone into exile in the land of Egypt rebuilt the temple there. So what's with that? Well, they wanted to do what God wanted in worshiping in a temple. It wasn't the temple. It was a different place. So the significance of place, a singular place, to worship a singular God, is just a big deal everywhere. And so when you get into the later periods of the kings, you see a number of texts that will tell us that the children of Israel were worshiping in the high places. That was a typical place where people would worship pagan gods, sometimes worshiping the true God in connection with that as well. But they were worshiping in high places. They were worshiping where groves of trees were. Any place that somebody else had been using to worship some god, they would worship the one true God. And so God didn't want that. That doesn't mean that God doesn't want to be worshiped. But one of the things we mentioned in our lesson this morning was God was very particular about how he wanted to be worshiped, where he wanted to be worshipped, and why he wanted to be worshipped, and the particulars that fill in all the blanks. So this exclusivity of worship makes it sound like God's narrow-minded. And that's an unfair characterization of who God is. You might say, well, if God was broad-minded, let people do whatever they wanted. Well, what if it did not honor and glorify him? What if it wasn't what he wanted? What if it not only didn't honor and glorify him, but it was too much like the worship of pagan deities that didn't have any basis in reality, that were just fanciful figments of people's imagination? Well, that doesn't honor and glorify God. So the uniqueness and the distinctiveness of God carries over into how he wants to be worshipped. And there's more about that brought out as we're going to go throughout the rest of the Old Testament. So notice, we touched upon this as well. The principles of holiness that are mentioned in the context of Scripture seem to be different. You know, why can't I eat this food? There's nothing about this food that's different than this food other than the fact that God said, don't eat it. That's it. There's nothing different about this food compared to this food other than the fact that God said, don't eat this one. Now, later, you know, in the context of the book of Acts, God removed those restrictions. Well, why did he have in place in the first, why did he have in place at all? In the context of the Old Testament, book of Leviticus and dietary restrictions to teach a principle of respecting his honor and his glory and being distinct for his sake, for no other reason than that. Now, some people have made a big deal about the health issues with reference to some foods, and I understand that, but that's not the primary thing. If it was bad for you once, it would be always bad for you, and God would have never allowed people to eat something that they shouldn't have eaten that would kill them or anything like that. That's not what it's about. It's an issue of being distinctive for the sake of honoring and glorifying God. The issue of what clothes you wore, the issues of who you can associate with, all of those were reflecting God's holiness. And so God's holiness was such that these were things that you had to do in order for God to live figuratively in your midst. Today, it's a different story. It's not, those restrictions don't apply. So all of these things about holy things and the issues that the Levites did, it was all about, remember, keeping God's house clean. Not physically clean, but spiritually clean. It's a principle of holiness. All right, more and more about idolatry. We'll talk about that as we get a little bit further. So the oneness of God extended to where he was going to be worshipped, how he was going to be worshipped, and what was going to be worshipped. And so, you know, as we get later into the history of the children of Israel, you're going to find many of the prophets, Isaiah and Jeremiah specifically, taking Israel to task for worshipping things that weren't at all like God. Now, how unlike God were they? Well, they were physical, and God's not. They couldn't move, and God can. They couldn't speak, and God can. They couldn't grant promises and make them come to pass, but God could. All of those things showed the futility of idolatry. And some of the language that's used is very, very stark. It's very strong. You know, you become what you worship. You become like what you worship. You are becoming less than what God wants you to be when you worship what's less than what God is. So those are issues that are going to be brought up later. Chapter 13, very quickly, you see it's only summed up in a few lines here. Idolatry doesn't make any sense. Well, again, if there are no restrictions about how God is to be worshipped, then there's no restrictions on what we are to worship at all. And so there are all sorts of things that can be worshipped. In the Egyptian deity system, lots of things were worshipped. That's part of what the plagues were designed to do, to show the futility of worshipping things that weren't really God. If you've ever looked into any of the medicinal practices of ancient cultures, it's very interesting. Why the Bible is Number One by Kenny Barfield. If you ever find that book, it's an excellent book. It may, I don't know, it's supposed to be reprinted. I don't know if it's been reprinted yet. But if you have to pay $35 for it and a used copy, it's worth it. Here's what Brother Barfield did. He was a head of Mars Hill Bible School in the Florence, Alabama area. And what he did, he studied all the health, medical, spiritual systems of ancient culture surrounding Israel and compared them with the Bible taught. And so some of the things that people did in order to present healings and magic incantations and spells were very interesting. So let's say you got a problem with your kidneys. What in the creation, the physical creation, looks like a kidney? Well, we have kidney beans, and they're kind of shaped like kidneys. Maybe if you eat kidney beans, it's good for your kidneys. You might think, well, that's a little corny. But that's kind of on the basis of what some things were done, that they looked at colors, shapes, textures that represented things in the human body. And if you did something with those things that look like that in culture, in the context of creation, then it's going to be good for you. You might think, well, that's just out there. But that's kind of the mindset that some of the idolaters were involved in some of the pagan practices of medicine and so forth. much of which went together. And so he says, don't be involved in those kind of things. Just don't be involved in those kind of things. And so the whole mindset of God, how God protected them, not only spiritually, but also physically, in principles of cleanliness and so forth, was interesting way back in the book of Exodus. All right. This is jumping into the future. But not everybody believed in germs 150 to 200 years ago. I think it's kind of in the news today. And so, you know, my point is, you know, what caused all these diseases and so forth? Well, there were principles of cleanliness that God had implemented in the context of what he wanted the children of Israel to do that were ahead of some of cultures' time, some of the time of some cultures years ago. Excuse me? Yes. And Mr. Spallanzani as well demonstrated that you've got to have contact with something for something to breed maggots. It won't go anything beyond that. All right. But anyway, it doesn't just happen spontaneously, right? So chapter 14, not only was idolatry condemned, but things that were part of the whole process of idolatry, the medicinal things, the worship things, those were also condemned as well. If you want to study ancient pagan rituals, it's fascinating. It's just you might think, I can't believe people would do this. So if you jump into the future and you see the contest that Elijah had with the prophets of Baal, what were some of the things the prophets of Baal were doing in order to induce their gods to consume the sacrifice that they had built? They're jumping back and forth. They were leaping, they were slicing, cutting themselves, and that sort of thing, in order to appease their gods and cause them to respond. And so, you know, Elijah was rather pointed, sarcastic. Maybe your gods are asleep, maybe they're on a trip, maybe they can't hear you, or maybe you need to do this a little bit more. And he wasn't trying to be funny, he was trying to make a point. Maybe nothing's happening because those gods aren't real. And that, of course, was the case. So the pagan rituals he was concerned about. Why? Because their temptation is to have some of those things rub off on God's people and to adapt and to acclimate themselves to doing things that God didn't want to be done because it didn't reflect God's honor and God's glory. And so that's a unique thing to be concerned about. Just, this is neither here nor there, but it just shows how people can be influenced by others. So years ago, I was watching a documentary, and it talked about a Rastafarian cult that had developed in an Indian reservation in Arizona. Well, how did that happen? Well, there was a gentleman who was in the service, an Indian reservation, and in the context of his time in the service, he was exposed to people of Rastafarian culture and practice and religion, and he brought it back to the reservation. Well, that made for an interesting dynamic on the reservation, because that's not at all what they were about. That's different. They were upset, because it violated what they thought was pure religion that they were supposed to do. And I'm not mocking them. I'm simply saying the admixture of different principles and practices in religion isn't exclusive to what God says. Don't do that, because that's not what I ask you to do. Others have had the same difficulty. So the point is, all of this emphasizes God's holiness as to be reflected in the holiness of the nation. One is supposed to be demonstrated in the other. The eating restrictions, we went through that in the book of Leviticus. I don't want to mention it again other than to say the principles of holiness are involved, not just dietary restrictions and not God just telling people what to do. What tithes were to be given, and so we mentioned this in passing, we'll touch on it again. It's not strictly a numerical percentage. And so if you had 10 cattle, the illustration I used before, and the 10 were worth 25 of the others, God wanted the top 10 that were worth 25 of the others. So the percentages were higher than just 10%. And so we've heard this concept of tithing so much, assuming that it's 10% of a number, not 10% of a value, which could have been more than 10% of the number of cattle that you had. The other thing is the principle of first fruits, that God wants what comes first. That's also brought in this context. So, notice, this is part of what we mentioned in the distinction last week that called attention again. In the Old Testament text of Numbers, as they were traveling, all of the sacrifices were offered in the context of where the tabernacle was. They weren't offering sacrifices in far-flung places. Why? Because they didn't live there yet. So as they moved through the wilderness, the whole sacrificial tabernacle system was concentrated wherever the tabernacle was. But when they came into the land, the people are scattered everywhere, All right? They're on the east side of the Jordan. They're in the north part of the land. They're in the south part of the land, east and west of the Philistines, up to the Jordan River and whatever. They're all over the place. And so the sacrificial system wasn't modified, but it was adapted in order to make sure that people understood this was where the sacrifice is going to be offered in the city of Jerusalem later, when the temple's built or at the tabernacle. But there were opportunities for people to offer sacrifices different places and bring their tithes and money to purchase something to do the sacrifice there. And then later, the sacrifices were actually done in different places. So another thing, the provision, the Levites weren't to be forgotten in their tithing. Why is that such a big deal now? Because they're about to go into the land. And the Levites aren't going to be camping where everybody else is. And so you've heard this principle, out of sight, out of mind. I haven't seen so-and-so in 100 years. Well, you know, you don't see them, you don't think about them. And so you don't see the Levites all the time. They're scattered throughout the land, and maybe people aren't going to support them like they're supposed to. And that's exactly what happened. And so I don't mean to say this in any kind of negative way towards the Levites, but they had to work sometimes to support themselves because people weren't supporting them to do what God wanted them to do. You might say, well, nobody's above work. That's not the issue. The issue was that's not the system that God set up. And so when you leave the wilderness and get to the land of Canaan, the law of Moses was still in effect. But how it applied was different practically, simply because now they're scattered in different places. Now, notice also that provisions were made for Levite strangers, fatherless, and the widows. As they're going through the wilderness, God's miraculously sustaining everybody. I don't have to worry about anybody not having what they needed. God took care of everybody. But when they get into the land, as you read in the book of Joshua, watch one of the things you're going to see in your reading the next week or so. As you get into the book of Joshua and they cross over the Jordan River and they conquer the city of Jericho, one of the things you're going to see is manna stops when their toes touch the other side. What's that mean? I'm not sustaining you miraculous anymore. And I'm not saying anything negative here with reference to our awesome God, but it's time for you fledglings to get out of the nest and fly on your own. I have sustained you to this point. Now I'm giving you this land. You use your time, your efforts, and your resources to help sustain yourself. I'm giving you this, right? So I'm giving you this and giving you a stake in this land or whatever. But now you're going to have to sustain yourself. And while you are there taking care of your own needs, make sure you take care of the needs of others. You might think, what? You're taking away our miraculous food. You're taking away the clothing that doesn't wear out. And none of these diseases. Now you ask us to work for ourselves. And then on top of that, to care for others. Well, that's what God's been doing for you for 40 years. He's taking care of somebody who's not him. Meaning them, the children of Israel. And so to be God-like when they got into the land, God wants them to take care of themselves and others, including the Levites, whom they were supposed to be responsible for, the strangers, the fatherless, and the widows. So there's an obligation on a huge dimension when they come to the land that they didn't have before. They didn't have it in Egypt. Why? Because they were slaves and somebody else was feeding them. They were working for somebody, they were getting food, but they weren't taking care of everybody else because they were the ones that were being taken care of. Now that they get into the land, there's a huge dose of responsibility that grows. There's a principle here. The greater God's demonstration of grace and mercy, the greater God's expectance of our responsibility to reciprocate that to him and to others. Does that make sense? Let me say it again. The greater God graces us, the more God expects from us based upon the greatness of the grace that we've received. There's a mindset in Romans that says, shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? Look, I can sin. God's going to outgrace me. I can't outgrace God. He's going to always outgrace me. So I can just keep on sinning. That's the wrong mindset. That's not accepting responsibility to stay away from sin rather than get involved in more sin, hoping that God's going to cover you. So the greater responsibility that God gives us by means of what he allows us to have without cost, redemption, the children of Israel couldn't pay for Exodus. They couldn't pay to get out of Egypt. They couldn't pay to be sustained. I mean, what would it cost to sustain 2 to 5 billion people for 40 years every day in the wilderness? All right? Doug, you got your calculator? Work that up. That's just huge. All right? When we get into the kingdom of Solomon and you see the provisions that he had to supply for all the people building the temple, those are tens of thousands, not millions. And it cost a tremendous amount of money. And so they couldn't buy that. So now they are going to have to demonstrate not only self-reliance, but they're also going to have to demonstrate selflessness in their care of others. All right, chapter 15. Now, again, these are all things that are going to take place when they get into the land of Canaan. So every so often, they're supposed to be engaged in a Sabbath year. Right, so some people that are involved in academics and other business enterprises, they're given time off because they've worked so long, usually every 7 years, the Sabbath year, that somebody is on a sabbatical, and sabbatical comes from the name Sabbath. Well, what's going on there? Well, we're going to pay you for the next year, but you can go work on whatever projects you want to. We had a gentleman that was a professor of agricultural economics at the University of Missouri, a member of the church when we lived in Puerto Rico years ago, that was on sabbatical. And he was traveling around the country doing studies for the Department of Agriculture. But he was on a release year. Well, here's what's interesting. Every so often, their land was supposed to be fallow. Don't grow anything there. But in addition to that, everybody who became indentured servants and or slaves were to be freed. And if they didn't want to be freed, there were provisions as to how that was going to be handled. Now you might stop and think, wait a minute, we got a problem here. God's already got it set up where we can't work one day a week. And in the book of Amos, the children of Israel were asking, when can we have our Sabbath day back? When will we no longer have to do this on the Sabbath? And they weren't asking about the new covenant being effect. They were wanting to do one more day of business. Incidentally, during the days of Nehemiah, Nehemiah had to lock the gates of the city of Jerusalem because people were rushing into the city on the Sabbath to do business. And then when he found out that they were doing business outside the gates, he had to have people run them off. Why? They were looking for ways to make bucks. The Sabbath year was not trying to cheat people out of making money. It was getting them to realize, rely upon God. Rely upon God. Remember the whole principle of the Sabbath day when it was first introduced? Don't go out on that day to pick up food. Why? What you got the day before will sustain you through that day. Now that's interesting. Whatever you get on that day will last the next day. Generally speaking, during the course of the week, as mentioned, if you gather too much, it's going to rot. It's not going to last the day over, the next day, because you're going to get more. But on the day before the Sabbath, what you got lasted. Now, if God can do that for a day, can he do it for a month? Can he do it for a year? Can he do it for 3 years? Yes. And all of those is what he did. So not only on the Sabbath year were they not supposed to let their crops grow, they were supposed to have enough for the year before, and God sustained them to allow that to happen. When there were 7 times 7 years, on the year of Jubilee, the year before that, they weren't going to have any crops, and the year and they were going to have triple the crops, because the next year after that, they had no crops, and the year after that was the Jubilee year, so they had 7 Sabbaths, that's 49 and then 50, and then they weren't going to have anything for 3 years, and God says, I will take care of you. You'll have an abundance of crops to get you through for 3 years. All right? How many people quit working for 3 years, assuming that God's going to take care of them? If you told people that, they're going to look at you like, you're crazy. You're one of those religious fanatics. Well, that's what God was doing to sustain them. God said, I will sustain you. I've given you the land. It will do what I've told you it's going to do if you do what I've asked you to do. Let me say that again. It will do what I've told you it will do if you do what I've asked you to do. That's a principle of taking God at faith. It's not blind faith. It's not a leap into the dark. It's taking God at his word. So notice, this is the responsibilities they have. Now, as you get further into the Old Testament, let me simply say this. You're going to see what we're seeing summarizing here all the time. God constantly tells Israel, show concern for somebody, not yourself. Show concern for somebody, not yourself. It's not about how big a car you drive. It's not about how big a house you have. It's not how much money you have in your account. It's, can you do what God has given you to help other people? That's all over the Old Testament. Now, this is not a political thing. This is a religious, moral, ethical thing. Responsibility of God's people is to help people, not just themselves. And not just because they look like you, think like you, or from your exact background. Indeed, as you go through the text, they're supposed to help anybody that has a need. That's the whole principle of the parable of the Good Samaritan. So notice, don't take advantage of people. One of the things there are, has anybody ever heard the expression predatory lending practices? What's that mean? Taking advantage of somebody because they don't have what you have. They may not have access to the way that you can get things done. So, well, they need money. I'll loan it to them, but I'm going to charge some exorbitant amount of interest. I got a check in the mail. It was literally a check from a lending company in Dahlonega. And the interest rate on it was like 59%. 59%. You borrow $100, you owe $159. I'm thinking, this is crazy. So I took a picture of it, and I didn't call them up, but I told them, please don't send me. I mean, I put on the thing, you know, to declined, and don't send me any more mail like that. 59%. What does it mean? It means you can borrow money from somebody, and you almost never get to pay it back. And that's happened in our culture to lots of different classes of people. And so here's the problem. Don't take advantage of poor people. All right? Don't take advantage of poor people just because you can. That's not right. You might say, why is God telling people this? This is telling people what to do with their stuff. Bingo. God's telling people what to do with their stuff. Who allowed them to have the stuff? God. Who allowed them to come into the land? God. Who helped them get all of these things? God. And so God is asking them, he's commanding them, but he's asking them to submit to his will and make sure you take care of others. So this whole section is about taking care of not Israel, but people who aren't Israel. That's everywhere in the prophets. And Moses is getting ready to talk more about that. So how you treat others, there's nobody should be mistreated for any reason whatsoever. You don't mistreat anybody. You don't mistreat anybody. Anybody. You can't say that enough. It makes no difference what somebody's circumstances are in life. You don't take advantage of them for any reason ever, 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 ever. You just don't. You should be willing to be defrauded and cheated and lied to before you would do that to anybody else. Paul said, I'm willing to spend and be spent. That's Bible. That's what God's teaching them. Be willing to put yourself out at cost for somebody else's benefit, even if they don't reciprocate in kind, even if they don't appreciate it, even if they kick you in the teeth, so to speak, and it's not doing something in order to get something back. If you do good only to those who are going to do good to you, you know, that's what everybody does. But Jesus said, even hate your, love your, those who hate you. So this responsibility is everywhere in this context. So the firstlings of the flock are going to be dedicated to God based upon the principle of firstborn, based upon the principle of first fruits. More about that as we go into the text. All right. Something significant here about the sacrifices that are going to be offered to God. Well, you know, if we're going to offer sacrifices to God, let's give God, you know, something that's not going to count. Something that's not going to cost us much. And if we're going to give 10%, we'll give the 10% that's at the bottom of the barrel that's not worth anything. You know, physically or some other way. And that's just not what God wanted. God always wanted the best. God wanted the best. All right, chapter 16. So when they come into the land, notice again, there are things that God's going to expect of them when they come into the land that they didn't do fully in the wilderness. Why? Because they were in the wilderness. Some things that they're going to do later in the feast, there are three feasts, Passover, Feast of Weeks, there's Pentecost, that's 50 days. Pentecost Day, the Feast of Harvest or Tabernacle, sometimes called the Feast of Booths. These were things that they're supposed to do when they come into the land. And it makes no difference where they lived. Anywhere, they were supposed to come to Jerusalem for those three great feasts. On the day of the Passover, people gathered together from the Roman Empire. Feast of Pentecost, all the different nations that are listed there are gathered together because God expected them to be there at a specific time, a specific place, for a specific purpose. Right. The Judges, we'll talk about that later as we get into the books of Joshua and Judges. There was a system of jurisprudence that God wanted to carry out. So they were not, quote-unquote, federally appointed judges, but they were appointed to take care of accusations, falsely or true, that were brought against individuals, and there was a system whereupon that was handled. All right. Chapter 17, we're covering a lot of material because we're going quickly, and I understand that's tough sometimes, but I want us to make sure we get close to where we want to be by the end of the evening, so we've got a little bit more time. So, I like headings like this. This chapter contains miscellaneous regulations. What does that mean? You know, it's kind of potpourri. It's not just one particular category. There's a lot of stuff that you're reading. If you were studying the book of Proverbs, sometimes it's almost like every other verse, the subject changes. The book of James is kind of like that. And so it's kind of a collection of things that they need to be responsible for. So, and the other thing is, some of these things have already been discussed everywhere before this, and so he's reminding them. So, rules are given about sacrifices. That's all over Leviticus, about idolatry. We've seen that before. Witnesses that are necessary to convict somebody. And so, you're supposed to have multiple witnesses in order for somebody to be convicted of something that they've done, if indeed that they have done it. How to make sure judgment isn't meted out in a less than just kind of way. The rules that were mentioned earlier about the poor are also mentioned with reference to justice. Somebody can't afford an attorney, might get railroaded. You might say, well, the court will appoint them attorney. Well, I don't want to get into the politics of this, but has it ever been the case where somebody didn't get a just trial because they didn't have just representation? The best representation, it happens all the time. There were three ex-army guys in Georgia that went to jail for a murder they didn't commit. It was all over the Atlanta Journal-Constitution just the other day. Spent 24 years in jail? 24 or 25 years in jail for a murder they didn't commit based upon one person's testimony. Not two, but one. And later the person said that he lied. He was afraid to go back because in the preliminary trial he said that he saw them. And he was told that if you go back on what you said, we'll charge you for perjury and we'll throw you in jail. So he didn't want to go to jail. So he lived with a lie for 25 years. I went and talked to those guys later and said, I was wrong. But can you imagine going to jail for 25 years for something you didn't do? That scares me half to death. There were provisions built into the law, so that kind of stuff wasn't going to happen. Don't take advantage of somebody because you can do it. For any reason. For any reason. All right. Notice also, we talked about this before, about when a king is going to become the supreme ruler in the land, other than God, of course. Provisions about they're supposed to write out the law in their own hands, and how the king is supposed to judge based upon what's written in the law. So they're writing out the law in their own hands, so hopefully as they were writing it, can't write it without reading it and thinking about it, that they're going to inculcate it. It's going to be ingrained within them. All right. Let me pause for a second. Questions, comments, observations about what we've ran through very quickly. We've gone through chapter 12 through 17. That's a lot. Anything need more attention? You know what they say at weddings, don't you? Speak now or forever hold your peace. Rod, go ahead.
So with the Levites, why was it that everyone else was having to provide for them instead of them for themselves? Was it because they were still watching after the tabernacle?
Yes, and I'm glad you mentioned that. Let me back up a little bit. When we read in the book of Numbers, and the book of Numbers starts off with a numerical count or census, hence numbers. One of the things that's brought out with reference to the numbers of the Levites was that God took the size of the Levites in exchange for all the firstborn that were passed over in Egypt. So there's a redemption price, if you will. And I'm saying if you will because you can't do anything to pay for what God did in passing over the death of the firstborn in the land of Egypt. And so God says they are mine. And because I have paid for them, in effect, by allowing everybody's firstborn to be spared, I'm taking the tribe of Levi as my own. All right? So, as God's special priests to serve in God's special place, the tabernacle, and then later the temple, God said, they're not going to get land inheritance like everybody else. That's going to come out the latter part of the Deuteronomy about distribution of land and in the beginning of the book of Joshua. And so there was a system set up so that they could be provided for by means of part of the sacrifices that were offered, but also by means of the tithes that everybody else is going to give. So there's a system that God set up for them to be involved in the worship of the tabernacle and later the temple. They're given cities, but not territory. So generally, and I don't want to make it sound like they never did anything, but their primary job description was anything and everything relating to the sacrificial system. When you get into the land of Canaan, and later when the temple's going to be set up, the temple, the beehive of activity was going on around the temple was practically nonstop all day long. Sacrificial system, vows, tithes, people in and out constantly. It was a large enterprise, part of which was set up by means of the organizational system. I'm going to say a flow chart, if you will, that David set up, that's chronicled in the Book of Chronicles. So there's a reason why God wanted them to be supported, and so that they could be free to do the work that he wanted them to do. In the New Testament, Paul cites passages from the Old Testament as well as in the teachings of Christ that talked about those who were involved in working for the Lord. It wasn't wrong for people to help support them. So he cites a passage, principally says, you know, the ox that treads out the corn, are you not going to feed it any of the corn that it treads? His point is, it's doing the work. Should it not get some kind of proceeds from the work that it's doing? And his point is that applies to people who are doing God's work. They need to be supported, if at all possible. Now, that didn't mean, in the context of Paul's life, he accepted support, but he also was willing to work to support himself. But that was outside of the Levitical system. Follow up, tell me, did I answer what you needed?
Yes.
And if not, you tell me. Okay. Mr. Bob.
Well, what you said, these laws and so forth, makes me more appreciative of James 1:25.
Yes, the perfect law of liberty.
Yes.
Yes. And that's interesting. It's a law, but it's a law of liberty. We usually look at liberty and law as if they're mutually exclusive. But they're not. Law is intended to protect people who need protecting from the people who don't want to abide by the law. That's part of what's brought out in the Book of Romans about civil authorities. But it's a law of liberty. The freedoms that we have in Christ are incredible, but we're cautioned not to use our liberty as a cloak to hide behind. Don't use it as something that you can cheat with. And that's part of what God's saying here with reference to everything he's giving you. I'm giving you all this stuff. Don't use it to your own advantage. Use it to the advantage of others as well. The man who is guilty of being a thief in the book of Ephesians, the 4th chapter, it says, let him that stole steal no more. So you don't steal anymore. That's good. But then it says he's working with his hands to take care not only of his own needs, but helping others to meet needs. I don't know. I'm going to go out and say something that may, you know, just tick people off royally, because we live in a Western capitalistic society. And a lot of people assume that means get all you can while you can for yourself. Well, that's really not a good thing to think about. You know, to be able to make money is fine, and to meet your needs is fine, but if that's the only reason you're making money to meet your needs, then that flies in the face of what God wanted Israel to do. He wanted them to be concerned about others. If we were more concerned about others and less concerned about self, it'd be a better world, right? That's part of what it means to love your neighbor. Some people might say, well, if you take that to the nth degree, everybody give everything they have away and everybody be equal. Well, that would be a dangerous place, wouldn't it? I'm speaking with my tongue in my cheek. No, it wouldn't be a dangerous place. You might say, I don't want to give all my money away. You don't have to. But you should do something to do what you can to help other people. Not just to salve your conscience, but out of genuine concern for others. All right? There are very well-known people who have lots of money, are going to give a lot of money away. You might say, I'm not Bill Gates. I can't give away billions of dollars. I'm not Jeff Bezos. Can't give away billions of dollars. You know, I'm not Warren Buffett. I can't give away billions of dollars. God says, if you're faithful in little, I'll be faithful in little. God wants me to be faithful with what I have, not with what I might be faithful with if I had a lot. If I had $1 million, I'd give all of it away. Well, you don't have $1 million. What are you going to do with what you have? That's the point. God wants us to be faithful with what we have. What if it's not a lot? You still have to be faithful with it. And being faithful with it doesn't mean hoarding it and using it exclusively for yourself. It means doing as much good as you possibly can. You can't read the Old Testament except that you see almost every other line, every other paragraph, every other page, God saying, what are you doing to help others, not just yourself? And it's not an indicting thing. This is not a socialism thing. This is not a capitalism thing. This is a do good to your neighbor thing because you love your neighbor. That's what it's rooted in. That's what it's rooted in. God gave them everything. What are you going to do with what I've given you to help somebody else? And it's a privilege to do that. And so that's why you're going to see passages like this all the time. All right. Initial part of the chapter deals with legislation with regard to the inheritance of the children of Levi. That's the cities that we talked about before. They don't get the land, so they don't have the means by which they're going to be able to support themselves fully. So somebody else is going to do that. And so there are provisions for that. Next chapter, again, warning against being involved in the different pagan rites. And again, I don't want to get off on this, But there are plenty of texts that if you look up, I'm about to tell you to look on Wikipedia, but you can find some information there that's going to be useful. But there are literal texts that are nothing more than scholarly studies of how far out some of the heathen and pagan rites were. And they're sad. And it's disgusting. And it's just, and it's scary to think that, you know, some of the things that people do. And people do scary, sad, disgusting things today. One of them in this context refers to Molech, that they would pass through the fire their children. What does that mean? This is not walking on hot coals. This is offering your children as human sacrifices. What good is that going to do? No good. Doesn't really appease a God, because a God didn't exist, and you've lost a child, and you've become a little bit depraved, to say the least. And so that's just one thing that's mentioned in this context. All right, this is significant, and we'll just introduce it and look at it later, because there's more. Moses speaks about a coming prophet. And so when John is involved in his ministry, the religious leaders come to him and say, "Are you the one that we're looking for?" And so there was the prophet model that's introduced in this passage. Moses said, there's going to be a prophet that's going to be like me from among you. That is, he's going to be from the children of Israel, that you're going to hear. God's going to speak through him. And so there was a constant connection to this, the prophet, that is mentioned in this context and then in other texts throughout the scriptures. That's mentioned in John chapter 1. And Jesus is going to be that, the prophet. That's quoted in Acts 3:22 and Acts 7:37. I mention it later there. That's going to be fulfilled in Christ. So Moses is a type of Christ. Didn't say Moses was Christ. It said he's a type of Christ. He anticipated something about what Christ is going to be like. He was a revealer. He was the means by which they came out of the land of Egypt. He was a redeemer in type, more in type than in reality, because God did everything, obviously. But he's going to be fulfilled in the nature of what Jesus is going to be like. All right, and then the latter part talks about prophets. Anybody can claim to be a prophet. I can claim to be a prophet. First, prophets are those who speak for God. And then prophets are often those who speak about what's going to happen in the future. Foretellers, not just forthtellers. But the most general meaning is prophets speak for God. They're not, very little of prophecy is actually predictive. Most of prophecy is dealing with people who are right smack dab in front of the prophets. And not all of prophecy is predictive, and a very small percentage of it is messianic, though that, of course, captures the attention of us because of the significance of it with reference to the coming of Christ. Chapter 19, very quickly, and we'll see more about this when we get into it. The cities of refuge that are going to be set up, that are places where people can go to receive criminal justice if everything's done right. That's established. There are three on the west, three on the east, and the system by which that judiciary review is going to be carried out, that's all spelled out in chapter 19. And again, when we get into the book of Joshua and Judges, we'll see specific details about that. All right, let me just finish 20, and then we'll take up starting with 21. So we're fairly close to where we wanted to be, not completely there. Rules about wars. Sometimes when I hear things about rules about wars, I think that's just very awkward, in part because it seems to me that a lot of wars are about breaking rules. But there were rules about how you engage and what you could and could not do and so forth in that context that have also contemporary application. So if somebody's brand new married, wasn't supposed to go off to war. Somebody just planted a vineyard, wasn't supposed to go off to war. So all these things are brought out in this context. There were provisions made for people to be exempted. And this is nothing to do with our military draft, nothing to do with the way that anything's done there. The point is, not everybody should be rushed off to war, and there are some provisions that are made about that. What you do with the people that you defeat? Well, some people's process was to annihilate everybody. And that's part of the mindset in some context in some countries. Notice the provision of peace that was offered. That's brought out in the context of counting the cost in the book of Luke. And then what's going to be done if they capture somebody, what they do with the money, what do they do with the captives. There are treatments that are presented in this context. And some of it's difficult to read, and there's background and context that we need to look at that's going to explain some of this, because it makes us queasy. Any time where somebody else is hurt in this kind of setting, it's bothersome, and I understand that. And we're not taking the time in this context to explain it. There are lots of things that need to be said about God's system of justice as it's meted out during times of conflict like this. So that doesn't do justice what the text says. We'll have to deal with some of that later. So let's start with chapter 21. We'll start an easy break. I've got a couple minutes past time. Stop there and